fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed, you'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Who.
Well, welcome everybody. Today we are talking with Jen Miller, journalist, author of 5 books, and the reporter and co-producer behind Blood Will Tell, the new limited series podcast from Wondery and Campside Media. Jen's work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, and many other esteemed publications. She holds both an MFA in fiction and a master's in journalism from Columbia. She has also spent the last decade running the Senior Media Fellows Program at the American Immigration Council, helping over 1,000 people tell their own immigration stories in their own words. The story that brought us here today started with a Washington Post assignment about Shakespeare being used in therapy and has ended with this rabbit hole that led to the creation of Blood Will Tell, covering the true story of 18-year-old An and Trong, Vietnamese-American identical twin brothers in San Jose, California, and a birthday party that turned fatal. Thanks for being with us, Jen.
Oh, thank you guys for having me and for that wonderful introduction.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. So you first encountered Trong while researching a piece about Shakespeare and healing in prisons, which is so, at what moment did you realize this was something much larger than the original story? And did any part of you hesitate to follow it?
So, great questions. So I was at San Quentin Penitentiary. I was reporting on this prison-based Shakespeare troupe. And they were rehearsing the final act of Othello.
Wow.
And Trong, I had wanted to speak with someone who was getting out soon. And so the director of the program introduced me to Trong. He was about 3 weeks from getting out, and we just sat down to talk. And I asked him, I just said, like, why did you sign up for this Shakespeare program? Like, why was that important to you? And that was literally all that I said to him. Mm-hmm. And he just spilled the most incredible story, the most like astounding story that I had ever heard in my life, that when he was 18, he and his identical twin brother An were at a birthday party, friends of friends, and An gets into a fight, and Trong rushes in and ends up stabbing an innocent man who passes away. The twins are both arrested, and An ends up taking the fall for Trong, because they are identical twins. They are both put in a lineup together. Mm-hmm.
Which is ridiculous. As an attorney, ridiculous that you would put two suspects in one lineup, much less two identical twin suspects in a lineup.
That's crazy. And the eyewitness picked out An twice. They ran the lineup twice. He picked out An both times. And so An sits in county jail for almost 2 years before Trong finally comes forward and turns himself in. And the story of the show is really – it is true crime, but it's really about their relationship and how it was that they ended up in this situation. Why did An take the fall for his brother, and why did it take Trong so long to actually come forward? And then, of course, the way that it ends is like no true crime story ends this way.
Yeah.
So there's so much to explore with it. But it's interesting, the idea that Trong was willing to open up to you kind of so quickly, but it's almost like Shakespeare helped facilitate that. You talk about spending time with men who can't really speak about violence about themselves in detail, but there is something about this art, you know, and Trong particular said that acting program really let him explore his pain. What do you think Shakespeare really gave these men that they didn't otherwise have?
Yeah, I mean, that is such a wonderful question. And it really speaks to why these arts programs are so important in prison settings. So as you mentioned, I mean, there's, you know, the men often don't feel comfortable expressing their own emotions, their own trauma, their own past. I think that there's also in state prison, there's like a sense of you know, what you're saying is censored, or if you say the wrong thing, you could get in worse trouble. So there's a lot kind of keeping people from actually opening up and expressing how they feel and kind of what they've been through. And, you know, a lot of these guys have really Shakespearean stories. Like mm-hmm. they have experienced a lot of trauma, violence. I mean, in Trung's case, mm-hmm. these twins, so they grew up in San Jose, California. There is a whole ecosystem out there of Southeast Asian gangs and organized crime. It's kind of tied to, I mean, it's an amazing immigrant community out there, but there are haves and have-nots like in any community. And the kind of aftermath of the Vietnam War in some ways created part of this ecosystem. And the twins, you know, fell into it, walked into it, were led into it. Lots of ways to think about mm-hmm. it. But it's very Shakespearean. You've got warring, mm-hmm. you've got warring gangs, warring organizations. And you have, you know, codes of honor, mm-hmm. codes of, you know, sacrifice and kind of, you know, not snitching. Like there's so much that really is rooted, feels so Shakespearean. And so yeah. I think for these guys, like being able to inhabit the characters in a lot of these plays, it allows them to tap into and express what they would otherwise not feel comfortable mm-hmm. being able to do.
For yeah. sure. It's a type of therapy. And it sounds like he was just willing and wanting and needing maybe to spill his story and was just waiting for someone like you to be a good listener to it.
Mm-hmm. That's my job.
Yeah, well, you're great at it because you've turned out a fabulous podcast. You're also a wonderful journalist. When you heard Trung's story for the first time, you said you couldn't believe that it was even real. What did it feel like to cover a true crime story that was almost too unbelievable to be real? What tactics did you use to drive down to the truth amid all of the very dramatic elements?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say that like the first part of this is that there would be no story if the twins did not trust me. Mm-hmm. And so in the beginning, it was really about earning their trust. And I think in some ways that process took such a long time, like necessarily so. We went over their story just again and again and again. Every time kind of, you know, I'm trying to draw out a little bit more, trying to maybe they seem a little more comfortable opening up different facets of that story. And so I think that when you are, you know, when you're talking to people and they're going over their story again and again and again, part of it is that like if something doesn't match up, then you're going to find out because mm-hmm. like over the course of 6 years, I mean, there's so many details and those details, the fundamental details never changed. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of them. So, you know, that was, I think, kind of in like the big picture, that was kind of what helped me to know like, okay, this is real. Of course, there's also all of the other research. So there, you know, we have all of the case files. They're speaking to both of their attorneys. There's watching the interrogations. There's video of them together in the holding cell, talking to their friends, their family, just really trying to drill down and really just try to fact check, you know, as much yeah. as I can. And so it's really just like this combination, I think, of it's like a puzzle and you're putting it together. And if like mm-hmm. a piece doesn't seem to fit, then you got to figure out, okay, well, like, why doesn't this piece fit? Like, is something off here? Is something wrong? And eventually the pieces came together.
Yeah, no, they really did. And it's such a fascinating story because it hinges on this silence, right? We have to sit with this uncomfortable moral position, which is on who was innocent, chose to stay silent while in prison for his brother's crime. So when you're reporting this, I mean, you did, I feel like your background allows you to bring in the cultural aspects of it as well. When you were reporting on it, I mean, as probably the listener I did you find yourself questioning, you know, decisions you saw on or Trung make? And as you were digging through and doing the massive amounts of research, did your initial thoughts change over time?
I mean, I'm always questioning everything.
Good.
And in part, you know, like it's really about it's okay. So I've been thinking a lot about this recently, about this F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, that the mark of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in your mm-hmm. mind at the same time. And you know, he goes on to say that basically, like, you know, the world is terrible and falling apart. You have to acknowledge that and still be willing to try to fight for what is right and mm-hmm. to make things better. Mm-hmm. I feel like that basically sums up our moment in American history. And I think that it really applies to this story because mm-hmm. there are a lot of reasons. I mean, yes, Trung, like, you know, cut and dry, like Trung should not have let his brother sit in jail for almost 2 years.
Yeah,
he's not going to dispute that. He, you know, if we're not putting a moral film on it and we're just looking at the psychology, like he had a process that he had to go through in order for this to happen on. And the podcast explores this. An had a mm-hmm. lot of reasons mm-hmm. for not turning him, for not giving up his brother. I don't mm-hmm. want to go into them because I don't mm-hmm. want to, you know, give it all away. But they're very complicated. Some of them are practical. Some of them are psychological, emotional. But they are both in certain ways at fault for what happened for this young man tragically, for them, you know, this young man that Trung tragically killed. They're both at fault in certain ways for that. And then when we think about kind of how the story ends and like whether, you know, back to Shakespeare, like, is this a tragedy mm-hmm. or is it something else? Yes, it is a tragedy, but it's not just a tragedy. Like if we look at kind of Trung's rehabilitative process and like being involved in the Shakespeare program, I mean, he comes out of prison. He gets his master's in social work. He is valedictorian speaker, and he is currently studying to become a therapist and has been working. He, you know, initially the state did not want to give him the opportunity to get a license because of his record. And it was overturned, and now he's on his way to doing that. And, you know, he knows that he can't make up for what he did, but what he calls it, living amends, which is this idea that like you can't ever right the thing that is wrong, but you have to continue to work toward making something right. And it's that Fitzgerald quote. You have to hold the darkness and the light in certain ways at the same time.
That's the purpose of prison. Yeah.
And we say a lot on the show that you can hold two truths at the same time, which is, you know, under the same vein. And you mentioned a lot their relationship and why he took the fall. We don't want to give all of it away, but it's very extensive and rooted in a lot of familial things. But in addition to the story being about sibling relationships, it's also very rooted in the Vietnamese American immigrant lifestyle, which you referred to in San Jose. There's a lot of gangs there, which they call the lifestyle. How much did that cultural context, do you think, shape what happened to them? And how did you choose to address that in the series?
Yeah. So the first thing I just want to clarify is that, you know, there is a very large, very robust, successful, culturally and economically, you know, rich Vietnamese American community in San Jose. It's about 10% of the population. And a lot of the twins' trajectory and kind of the road that they took had a lot to do with their own personal immigration story. And it's definitely tied to larger, like, geopolitical factors. Sorry, but the thing that I just want to make clear is that, like, the lifestyle specifically refers to not Vietnamese American lifestyle, but to this kind of corner of Vietnamese San Jose that is tied to gangs and organized crime. So just want to be really, I know you didn't mean to just, I got to be really clear.
Yeah, no, it's good. We appreciate it. Well, you're
about that.
And you have expertise in helping share the immigrant story experience through your policy fellow work. So no, that it was fascinating to hear how different people from different cultures, because another gentleman was of Cambodian descent and ended up in the lifestyle as well. So it does seem like it's a subset of just in that area, and when he said, oh, we were growing up and I realized like, oh, we're on welfare, you know, we're on these programs and we are the have-nots that you mentioned earlier. So yeah, it seems like it's not just the Vietnamese community. There's trying to take advantage of folks that are having a tough time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of refugees. And a lot of it is our, you know, I mean, you don't obviously being a refugee, like refugees actually do incredibly well, relative to many other immigrants who come here, like statistically in terms of like economic advancement. But I think when you have suffered a lot of trauma and you're not given the support that you really need to process that trauma and deal with that trauma, then it can be a slippery slope. And I certainly put our country at fault in a lot of ways for at least in the twins example, for some of what happened with their family. I mean, their dad was a soldier in the South Vietnamese army. And then after Vietnam fell to the communists, he spent almost 3 years in a re-education camp. Mm. And when he was finally released, he was desperate to come to the United States because his whole city was targeted. People who had fought for the South Vietnamese army were targeted. Their ability to advance was really limited. I mean, it was a very repressive society for people on the wrong, quote unquote, wrong side, not on the communist side. And we had programs to help those people, to bring them here. Their dad, Duk, was maybe 2 or 3 months short of the amount of time that he needed to be in that re-education camp in order to take advantage of the immigration programs that we had set up. And I mean, that just speaks to the arbitrariness of a lot of this and how whether we can't or we don't, it's debatable, but we are not able to – we get into these wars and then we don't really help the people who we have hurt or displaced, or we try to and we fall short.
Oh, yes.
And in a lot of ways, that's what happened. And I'm not drawing a line between that and Trung's decision to kill this man. That's not in any way what I'm saying. But I think that for him and An and for Kevin, the Cambodian gentleman that you were referring to, they're growing up in poverty. They don't know who they are or who they're supposed to be in this society. And their parents are really struggling. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea, well, you've got to claim the American dream. And it doesn't seem accessible to them. But what is accessible and what is kind of everywhere are these gangs outside their front door and the money and the power and the belonging that come with that.
No, yeah. It was very heart-wrenching to hear, On say, he gave me a pair of shoes. They gave me a pair of shoes and that made me feel like I belonged. And then years later, you look at yourself and go, oh my gosh, like how did I go from, this is my parents' story that now I'm like in a gang? Like what? But you can trace it back to these tiny momentary little touchstones. Mm-hmm. And you've covered immigration, identity, belonging in your books and your journalism. Did your prior work give you a framework for really understanding what their childhood immigration from Vietnam meant to who they become? Or, now your experience with this story, did it kind of challenge what you thought you knew about the experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, certainly, working for the American Immigration Council on the storytelling project for the last 10 years and just talking to so many immigrants, so many refugees about their stories, including Vietnamese refugees, really gave me, I think, a good framework to come into this project. But I hadn't, and I had studied the Vietnam War quite a bit. I actually, earlier in my career, I did a lot of reporting on veterans of the Vietnam War, American veterans of the Vietnam War, and like the trauma that many of them brought back, post-traumatic stress, and like efforts to kind of heal that. And I hadn't really looked at it from the Vietnamese side. Mm. And that was what was really, really different about this project. And then coming into it, I was able to kind of like take that storytelling work and that kind of empathetic listening and humility, I think, that is really required when you're, dealing with people's very precious, very raw firsthand experiences, plus kind of the mental health reporting and the knowledge that I had of kind of just everything that had happened between the United States and Vietnam. It all kind of coalesced into this. And then, of course, having really smart people on my team who are from the Vietnamese American community. In fact, one of our producers actually grew up in the same housing complex that the twins did.
Wow.
And so, you know, she had a really good sense of, you know, that community, that culture, and what that was like. I think it really comes down to knowing that if you're not as a reporter, just asking all the questions and being very humble that, like, there's a lot that I don't know, and it's my responsibility to learn as much as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, because to spend 2 years in jail for something you didn't do, like On did, and by all accounts, he made that choice for himself. When you finally did sit down with him, what did you find? Was there anger, resentment towards his brother? Had he made peace with it? Like, what, how did he feel?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I talk to these guys every week for maybe 4 years. Yeah. Wow. And sometimes I talk to them together. Sometimes I talk to them separately. They were actually living together after Trung. So Trung turns himself in, An gets out. And then when Trung finally gets out, they move in together. And it's almost as though they are living their lives as though this hadn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that I couldn't understand. You know, it's like, I know that you guys are so close, but there's this betrayal or abandonment and all these unresolved feelings, and you're living in the same house and, like, you're not talking about it.
Yeah.
And it took me a really long time, I think, to figure out, like, why weren't they talking about it? And, like, An, in particular, who is very, you know, is, like, very open about his story, had, I think, for a long time, had a lot of trouble articulating, like, his emotion. I mean, this is so much of this, of the actual story, right? That, like, these guys are raised in this environment where, like, you're not supposed to talk about how you feel. You can't talk about how you feel. Trung had the benefit, actually, of going to prison and being part of that Shakespeare group and being part of this other organization that trained him to be a substance abuse counselor. And in the process of that, really forcing him to unpack all of his feelings and trauma for that training, An did not have the benefit of any of that. And so I mean, I don't know, it's weird to think about it like this, but I almost feel like interviewing him over all of these years for this show was like some kind of weird, I'm not a therapist, but like weird de facto therapy.
No, definitely.
Where, like, over time, he became more comfortable and more comfortable opening up until many years in, that some of that anger and frustration and just raw emotion, like, started to come through. And once that happened, and once I saw that he, like, had – he was able to articulate those feelings, then I thought, okay, I need to see if both these guys will sit down together for a, like, real conversation about how they feel. Like, not about what happened, because they had sat down – many times to tell me what happened, but how they feel. That's the last episode of the series.
Save the last. Save the best for last.
No, absolutely. Because they were dealing with not just, like you said, not just the cultural, the emotional, but also quite practical issues of, if you are known as a snitch, it's bad. If you are known as a person who's so willing to snitch that you snitched on your very own twin brother, it's catastrophic, existential, life ending. So understanding that, you know, An remained silent, but Trung eventually did turn himself in. So in your view, what do you think it was that finally moved him to understanding, yes, there may be life, you know, lifestyle repercussions. Obviously, I'm about to go to jail. You know, my own sort of deal I'm negotiating here. But what do you think it was that finally moved him? And do you think ultimately justice was served in the case? Or does that kind of feel reductive, just given the complex nature of the whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, so what finally moved him? So this is another kind of Shakespearean element. Trung, this happens in the maybe fourth or fifth episode, I can't remember. But Trung has a really good friend who is, like, really, like, one of the few people that has stuck by him while An is sitting in jail. And this friend, very much like Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, Mercutio is Romeo's cousin, but he's kind of neutral. He like doesn't really take sides. He's able to kind of go back and forth. And there's this moment where Romeo is fighting with Juliet's cousin and Mercutio kind of steps in the middle to stop the fight and loses his own life mm-hmm. because he's stepped in the middle. And a version of this act like very thing happens to Trung. And I think that it is watching this happen to his very close friend is the beginning of the wake up call in which Trung starts to realize I have hurt so many people. I've ended one life. I have maybe led to the killing of my friend. And I've ended my brother's life by keeping him in there for so long. And I have to start making amends. And so that's kind of that's what sets Trung on the path to really come forward.
Rock bottom. Yeah.
It's fascinating how Shakespeare repeatedly plays into this time and time again. There's also a silence at the center of this story. Maybe you felt while making the series, the man who Trung killed is not present in the narrative because his family did not agree to speak on record. How did you navigate that part as a storyteller?
That was the hardest part of all of this. And I don't want to talk about it too much because I know they don't want to be brought into this. And I think they're probably very upset with me for making a story that has positive things in it about the guy that killed their son, brother, friend. I don't know. I think it was really hard. We really tried to reach out to them. And I actually think I tried every avenue that I could to try to reach them. I had never reported, I'd never reported my way through this specific scenario before. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, I do wonder if like my like intense follow-ups trying to find them felt really intrusive probably. Mm. Even though like from a journalistic perspective, it's your due diligence because, you know, there was a version of this show that would have really centered Trung's victim. And initially, that's what we were hoping that we would be able to do because we did not want to like, quote unquote, let Trung off the hook, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to hold him accountable in all these ways. And that just wasn't going to be possible. So that is the absence at the center of the story.
Well, we appreciate, you know, you talking about holding two truths and things, because on the show, we're always talking about what's the point of the criminal justice system? Is it retributive? Is it restorative? Is it rehabilitative? And what I think most people want, most victims' rights advocates and things want, is truly a rehabilitative criminal justice system and showing Trung not just how the Shakespeare even got him to open up to tell a story at all, but that what the healing that has happened after he's been willing to open up a story. And, you know, you think all the future clients that he's going to go on and help. And you've written 5 books, you run this program helping immigrants find their voices through writing. And now you have this true crime podcast grounded in Shakespeare. It's all sort of orbiting these similar themes about the power of storytelling to reconcile us with difficult truths. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is this is a true thing that happened to these brothers. So what do you think this particular story sort of offered you that your prior projects haven't? Was it just that confluence of you felt like you've been kind of prepping for this throughout your other projects?
I mean, I definitely felt like I've been prepping for this throughout the other projects. But, you know, I mean, I think this was really the first time that I had reported so closely on someone who had committed a violent crime. Like I had I had reported on victims of violent crimes, but I had never reported on someone who had killed someone. And I didn't really know, my feelings over that, like as we went along, like really, really evolved. And I just didn't know, I felt really uncomfortable with that, for a long time. And then the longer you spend with someone, the more you get to know them, and you get to know them in, you know, 360 degrees. And then there's this question of like, you know, should people be forever blamed or judged or, you know, for the worst thing mm-hmm. that they've ever done? And how do you tell a story that both in no way minimizes the tragedy of and the monstrous thing that, you know, Trung did, with the potential and possibility for change? People can change.
That's all we want.
Trung, I mean, I've watched both Trung and An go through these incredible changes. In some ways, like, I mean, and their, I mean, their lives are like, they're going to be better parents.
Oh yeah.
Than they are not, I don't know, better parents than their parents, but like they are going to raise their kids in a very intentional way.
Yeah.
And that breaks, that is cycle breaking. Mm-hmm. That breaks that traumatic cycle, that generational trauma cycle. And that is incredible. And that's like what we need to hold on to and remember, because we need a criminal justice system that is going to allow for more of that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. Well, at some point during all your years of reporting, you had to decide, okay, we got to put this out into the world. How did you decide kind of what made the final cut? Were there things that areas you started to explore, but then later decided, nah, we're not going to include this? Like, is there anything you still don't even fully understand about the case maybe that wasn't included?
I mean, there was so much. and I wish that we had had more. I wish that we had had more than six episodes. I mean, I'm like a history nerd. I really wanted to go more deeply into the kind of culture and society and history around the establishment of the Vietnamese community in San Jose, around how these gangs got started, and to really look at that more closely. And we just weren't, for a variety of reasons, we just weren't really able to do that. There's definitely, I think, like when you're making a show like this, there's a lot of people basically saying like, it's got to be propulsive. Like every episode, every act has mm-hmm. to have a cliffhanger.
Much like Shakespeare.
Exactly. But sometimes it feels a little bit like, I don't know. I just like, I'm very happy with how it turned out. But I would have maybe cut down on a little bit of the drama. There's enough drama in the story to say that much.
But there were
things that I wasn't able to go into, primarily because of safety concerns. Mm-hmm. And that was really the thing. That was like the main like kind of fear that I had working on this show over this time. Because, you know, the twins are putting their trust in me mm-hmm. to keep them and their families safe. Now they're willing to tell the story, right? So like nothing, you know, I did not push them in any way. Like I got to be really clear about that. Like they were willing partners in this, but there were certain things that happened that they basically said to me, we are not comfortable having this shared publicly, because there are no criminal records of, like, you know, their police were never involved. So it's not like it's in the public, you know, public record. And it goes back to that code of like mm-hmm. not snitching. We just, the fallout of revealing some of this stuff could be too dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had to balance that, which I took very seriously, with also telling a good story. And there are, so, you know, you'll know, there are a few moments in the show where we kind of get right up to an event. And then I have to say, okay, I can't actually tell you what happened. You have to trust that, mm-hmm. like, it was serious. mm-hmm. Because here's the fallout, right? I mean, we skip over that action and we get to the repercussions. Mm-hmm. And I don't do that a lot, like, very sparingly. But I was really intentional about that because the twins are trusting me. And so I had to follow their lead on that stuff.
especially when safety is a factor that to consider mm-hmm. as well. And that's, like you said, if in the past you've more reported on the victims of crime versus the perpetrator, and the perpetrators run in a little bit different world sometimes, and there are things you do not expect to encounter. Mm-hmm. Man, what a story. Thank you for trusting us with sharing it with our audience here today, Jen. Thank you very much. And I'm glad that you got a simple assignment about Shakespeare, and it has led all these years later to such an unexpected place.
And thank you guys for asking these amazing questions. It's really thoughtful. I appreciate it.
Man, it's a fascinating story. And, it is. And well told.
It's fascinating how our first, you know, kind of theatrical bard is still so relevant and therapeutic, you know, centuries later, and is still helping people kind of learn how to express their emotions and be vulnerable in the toughest of situations. And as you said at the beginning, that's what we want prison to be. And I would love to see a program like this in all prisons that allows people's walls to come down and speak their truths.
Yeah. I mean, if you're, you know, every, as far as I know, every prison in California has access to the Shakespeare program.
I love that.
And That's really remarkable. Mm-hmm. So we need it in more states across
Absolutely.
The country.
Take it nationwide. Seriously. I mean, there's something that, like Christy said, it's from the 1600s. If those plays not only just resonate, but resonate to the point that they are drawing someone out into a rehabilitative space, there's something to be said about the universality of human truth that we mm-hmm. all share.
Absolutely. I have to give a shout out to the Marin Shakespeare Company, because they're the ones that run the program. Leslie Currier is the director.
Please do.
And they just do amazing work.
Well, everybody, in every way you can, support a group like that and figure out how to get one started in your neighborhood. This is, you know, California can't have it all on lock. We need Shakespeare here in Texas as well, for sure. And if you all want to hear the full story of Trung and On, Blood Will Tell is available right now from Wondery and Campside Media. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart, or you can binge the whole series ad-free right now on Audible. We put all the links for you in the show notes. Thanks, Jen, for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much for having me.